Blog Talk Radio.
911, what's your emergency?
I called a little bit ago. The deputy sheriff saying that I found out my granddaughter has been taken. She has been missing for a month. Her mother finally admitted that she's been missing.
Okay, what is here now? Okay, what is the address that you're calling from?
We're talking about a 3-year-old little girl. My daughter finally admitted that the baby's in the store. I need to find her.
But the daughter admitted that the baby is where?
But the babysitter took her a month ago that my daughter's been looking for. I told you my daughter was missing for a month. I just found her today, but I can't find my granddaughter. And she just admitted to me that she's been trying to find her herself. There's something wrong. I found my daughter's car today, and it smells like there's been a dead body in a damn car.
Okay, what is the 3-year-old's name?
Kaylee. C-A-Y-L-E-E. Anthony.
Kaylee Anthony?
Yes.
Okay, is she white, black, or Hispanic?
She's white.
How long has she been missing for?
I have not seen her since the 7th of June.
What is her date of birth?
8-9-2000. Oh, gosh, she's 2005. George Kane is missing.
Welcome to Voices for Justice. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and live from Orlando, Florida tonight, we examine the forensics in the Casey Anthony trial. Are the forensics fact or fiction? You be the judge. Tonight's guest will be taking your calls. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. The chat room is also open. Log on to blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes and click tonight's program. Tonight's guests are Beth Karras, correspondent for In Session on True TV, Dr. Lawrence Kobolinski, one of the forensic experts on the defense team, and Shelley Schaefer, forensic professor and criminal investigator. And we welcome Dr. Kobolinski, as well as Shelley Schaefer and Beth Karras back to the show from last night. Welcome to everyone.
Hello.
Hi there. Pleasure.
Hi.
Welcome. And I know Beth is going to stay with us for a few minutes, but we definitely want to dig into the forensics, so we'll follow up with that as soon as we find out, Beth, what in the world happened tonight, or this morning, rather, in that courtroom. I don't think we predicted this kind of drama last night on last night's show.
Oh, no, we didn't. Now, you may recall that Saturday, the defense wanted to call a man named William Rodriguez. They started to call him, a forensic anthropologist who also has expertise in entomology. And just before he elicited an opinion that went to the heart of the state's case, Jeff Ashen, the prosecutor, was on his feet, objected. There was a sidebar. And then the jury was sent out, and his testimony was taken without the jury present, and it was learned that he had a new opinion that wasn't in his report and hadn't been a part of his deposition. And so the judge was like, you're not going to do it. This is violating my order. And he stopped the testimony, and another witness, Werner Spitz, the pathologist, was called instead so that Jeff Ashen could depose him Saturday afternoon and be prepared for him today. So William Rodriguez was supposed to be the witness this morning. Before bringing in the jury and Rodriguez, Jeff Ashen was on his feet saying, Your Honor, I deposed him from 1:45 to 3:45 Saturday after court. I got the transcript. I've had a chance to review it once. There's another new opinion in there and a few other smaller ones I can probably handle on the fly, but I need time to look at it again before he's called, so I just ask that he not be the first witness. And then there was, and the judge granted that, but the next witness they wanted to call, Jeff Ashen already knew about, a person with expertise. Well, he said he wasn't sure it was like a crime scene, but he was going to talk about DNA and the absence of evidence, absence of DNA. And his name was Eichenblum. And he said, I had received a one-page report from Mr. Eichenblum in the past, pursuant to the judge's order, but there was nothing in it, really, no opinion, and so I didn't depose him. And he showed up at my office on Saturday. night, Saturday afternoon, night, or whatever. And I sent him away. And then Jose Baez, and he said, well, now I got a two-page report along with 45 slides of a PowerPoint presentation. And I was like, there's an opinion in there. And I got this late Saturday. So I need time to depose him, and I'm going to do it Tuesday after work. Then Baez got on his feet and needed to explain what was going on and why this late disclosure of a report with opinions. And he said he was, like, doing his best. He had sent him to the office. I was giving him an opportunity to be deposed. And he just didn't follow the procedure. He didn't follow the procedure of getting a report first and then the deposition, because the report came after Eichenblum offered himself up to be deposed. It was all a mess. The bottom line is, Ashton needed a little more time to get ready for Rodriguez, and he needed to depose Eichenblum. The judge wasn't happy. He came down. He lowered the boom, chastising really both attorneys, but it was focused more on Baez, because right now it was Baez who hadn't followed the procedures, although one could argue there was a little gamesmanship on Ashton's part, too, but not with Eichenblum, with Rodriguez. So something happened. They went into chambers because a third witness was supposed to come and didn't come. They went into chambers, and then the judge said, okay, we're done for the day. Both sides agree. We're done. Come back 9 o'clock tomorrow. I suspect he said, get everything done today. Finish your depositions. Do what you need to do. I'm not stopping this trial anymore. Get it all done now. And so that's what's happening. Court will resume tomorrow, I think, with Rodriguez.
Have you ever seen anything like this in a courtroom before? Didn't they go to the judges' chambers three times today?
Well, they did go in and out at least twice. Might be three times. Have I seen anything like this? I don't know that there's anything on point like this, but I mean, I've been either trying cases or reporting on cases for 25 years, and I've seen about everything. And I have seen a lot of acrimony between attorneys. I've seen problems with experts and new opinions coming out on the stand. Not everybody requires what this judge required in this case, that the experts reduce their opinions on the factual basis to writing in a report at a both sides exchange well in advance. No state besides Florida has this investigative tool of depositions in a criminal case. It's an amazing tool that adversaries have in preparation for a criminal trial. So I've seen expert witnesses come out with brand new opinions the prosecution never had notice of in the middle of trial in front of the jury, even worse than what we're seeing here.
So even though all of this didn't transpire in front of the jury this morning, they had two delays, and then he called for a recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. What effect does this have on the defendant in the perception or perspective of what happened in that courtroom, knowing that it's the defense's time? What kind of judgment is coming from the jurors, do you think?
Well, the jurors know nothing about what happened in the courtroom. They shouldn't, and they're sequestered. So they really shouldn't be holding anything against, hopefully not against Casey Anthony, because even anything the lawyers do, it's not her fault. And the judges are often, and Judge Perry will instruct the jury at the end, and maybe even before the end, not to hold any of this against the defendant. That these things happen in trials, there are scheduling problems, and just let it be, and they'll be free to speculate. Hopefully it won't hurt. I like to think that jurors don't hold it against one side or the other, but they might, some might, but they follow instructions for the most part. Jurors are good. There's no greater mind than the collective mind of 12 jurors.
Now, with the 12 jurors there, they don't know that the experts only did a half a page sheet report, correct?
No.
Okay.
They don't know that, although at some point it could come out on cross-examination, but they don't know that right now. We know always more than they know.
And is that typical? Oh, go ahead, Shelley.
Didn't Jeff Ashton, though, have enough time to read the report? So is he to blame a little bit as well? Because he depoed the guy, Rodriguez, Dr. Rodriguez, on Saturday afternoon for a couple of hours. So he did have enough time to read that report. So wouldn't he be to blame a little bit as well, or no?
Well, one could argue that he should. He asked for a little more time today. He wanted another hour or two. He just didn't want Rodriguez to be the first witness because he just needed to go through the transcript. He had already depoed him, taken the deposition, and this was the transcript, and he was just marking it up and making sure he was ready and just getting his ducks in a row for his cross. He just needed a couple hours, I think, not a day, and that was what was granted. But, you know, he could have taken a deposition of Rodriguez before. No, I guess he couldn't have. This is a new opinion. I take that back. He had done it before. This is on the new opinion. It was Eichenbloom. He could have taken a deposition before, even though the report didn't have any opinions. He still could have done it. That's where maybe there was a little gamesmanship. He waited because he knew he could make this argument when in the middle of trial.
I was glad to see that you made a point because I was on the same line as Jane Velez. Well, he had all day Sunday, but as you pointed out, it was Father's Day. And
Come on, give him a break.
You know, I guess give him a day off, you know. Being prepared, I understand that they should be. Shouldn't there have been other witnesses ready to testify, though? Or is that not protocol in a defense or a prosecution to have their witnesses at least, in case something like this happens?
Well, ideally you should, and judges usually come down a little harder on prosecutors for that. You know, I used to be a prosecutor, so I say we had the burden, and you've just got to have a lot of witnesses lined up. You don't want to run out of witnesses. It's just the worst thing is to say to the judge at 3 in the afternoon, I'm sorry, judge, we've gone through all the witnesses. So you have more than you need if you can. The defense had two experts ready. They may have taken the whole day if they could have gotten them on the stand today. I don't think they anticipated this issue today. And the third witness they needed to go and get. And so they thought at 9:30 they'd have that witness there at 10:30, and then something happened, and they were in chambers and said, okay, forget it, you know.
Do you know who that witness was?
No, but I do know they were going to spend time with forensics today and tomorrow. That was the plan, I believe. I don't think they're going to get to Roy Kronk and, you know, maybe recalling George and Cindy to a little bit later in the week. Now maybe it's pushed to Thursday. I'm not sure.
And now you're going to see the jury have to work all day Saturday? Is that what I heard the judge say?
Yes. Instead of quitting at 1 o'clock, it's a full day. But I don't think these jurors will mind. They really want to work because they won't go home. They wanted to work on Memorial Day, Monday, but the judge couldn't get it together to get the overtime, you know, budget in place to operate the courthouse.
What do they do at the hotel the entire time if they can't read a newspaper, you know, go to Disney World, you know, they can't do anything? What are they doing? Are they allowed to talk to each other?
Oh, yes, and they do get visits from family members on weekends, is my understanding, and they are constantly supervised, and there are approved movies. They have movies that they can watch, DVDs. They get sanitized newspapers, you know, with cut articles cut out. And there have been some activities which we are not privy to, and restaurants they go out to eat, but they're always under sort of supervision. They're with deputies.
I know we have a few minutes with you. Call anyone that would like to ask Beth a question this evening, 347-838-8622. We do have a caller on the line from the 318 area code. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question for our panel?
Yes, I do, and good evening.
Good evening.
I'd like to clarify with regard to some statements that I've heard y'all make in error. Mr. Ashton worked on Sunday. It was Sunday that the man showed up at his office hoping to be able to be deposed. Mr. Ashton pointed out in court that he couldn't get a court reporter on Sunday, and that's why he had to schedule it for Tuesday. So, being Father's Day, Mr. Ashton was at the office and he was working on Sunday.
He did say that, did he? I thought he said it was Saturday night. Good point.
He took the other man's depo on Saturday.
He did. Saturday, got the transcript Saturday night.
On Sunday, and the second fella showed up at his office on Sunday. Go back and listen to it.
I will.
So Ashton was
Thank
at
you for
work
the correction.
On Sunday. Now, with regard now for my question to Mr. Kobolinski, Dr. Kobolinski. How are you, sir?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Good. I'm real concerned that there's a dispute over the Death Banded Hare. I think one Death Banded Hare is too many. And some seem to think that one's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion on that?
Well, a lot of the work, the original research work done on the hairband was done at my institution at John Jay College by graduate students who have subsequently become leaders in their field. But basically, the hairband is essentially air pockets that to the naked eye, the band looks dark. Now, it is true that hair that is present in a decomposing body will develop this banding pattern, and it is used often to, signify decomposition. But on the other hand, there are three things that are important. First of all, we don't know the mechanism for how this band forms. That's number one. And what I'm trying to say by that is you need more research. This is an early development of the science of banding. Number two, there is one of the theses that were generated from John Jay indicated that you can have a hairband form not as a result of decomposition, but by exposure to certain environmental factors. So that results in a question that it remains unanswered. Again, it points out that the research hasn't been completed in this field. And thirdly, is that what you've heard already, the way they have associated the hair to Kaylee is through mitochondrial DNA. And as you know from what you've heard, all maternal relatives have the same mitochondrial DNA. What you may not have heard is that even unrelated individuals can share the same mitochondrial DNA based upon what the analysis is, depending upon the number of genetic markers looked at. So there are three issues, and I'm not saying that this is not a decomposition band. I'm not saying it is. The point is that it's still a very young science. And my concern is that in a capital case where the state is seeking the death penalty, we want to use the most reliable science and not present data that says maybe. You know, I think jurors want to hear the science because it provides them with facts that they can then make their ultimate decision, guilt or not guilty. But I'm concerned about the science, and the hairband is just one of those issues that is not really clear-cut.
Well, I think the death banded hair coupled with the dead body down the street, coupled with the smell in the car, coupled with the line for 31 days, pretty well resolves it in my mind that it's really a death banded hair. Thank you for your analysis. To Michelle Bart, you were very instrumental in helping George and Cindy Anthony in their campaign for finding the missing child. Do you feel you were duped now that you're informed under the opening arguments of Jose Baez that the child was never missing to begin with?
I don't feel like I was duped by George and Cindy Anthony, and that is who I was there to help, was George and Cindy, in an effort to help keep their granddaughter's face and case visible. We 100% succeeded in that. If anyone was duped, it was the entire family and the entire world who followed this case. So I'm not taking it personally. I went and did what I was there to do, and I'd do it again. And I believe in George and Cindy's innocence at this point.
I agree with you that the world has been duped, and I've said for a long time the whole thing was a big hoax.
Can I ask a question to the caller?
Okay.
Do you believe that in this country there's a presumption of innocence until proven guilty, and do you think that Kaylee is getting that presumption of innocence?
I think she's getting more than that presumption. I think she's getting a lot more than someone else in her same shoes would get.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a question? This is Net Detective. I'm on with Pip. I have a question to Dr. Kobolitsky. I'm a little confused because I really love Dr. G, and I think she did a spectacular job, and, you know, Dr. Spitz kept saying because she didn't take the skull, the top of the skull off, that she did a, you know, a sloppy job. I went back and looked at some protocol for analysis of skeletal remains, which I know nothing about. But it looks like to me, I mean, if you look at everything on it, I don't know what the state of Florida's criteria is, but it looks like she did everything. I don't see anything that says you need to cut the top of the skull.
Well, my experience and having talked to many pathologists, virtually everyone without dissent tells me that you are supposed to remove the cranium and examine the inner portions of the skull, simply because there may be evidence within the skull itself that you can't see just by washing out the contents. And quite frankly, there's no reason not to do it. The autopsy is supposed to be an analysis from head to toe, and leaving no stone unturned. It's quite a surprise when I heard about the autopsy and the fact that Dr. G did not remove the cranium. I was surprised, and I think this has been borne out by what Dr. Spitz has said. He indicated that in his report that this was not following procedure. Now, obviously, there may be different procedures in Europe, in South America, there may be different procedures, but the procedures that I've read about and am familiar with require the opening of the cranium.
I'm going to send it over to Beth. She's going to have to go. Beth, do you have any input on any of the caller's questions?
No. I just had a question for Larry, because I think everybody covered everything. I just wanted to know whether or not the failure to open the skull invalidates everything else Dr. G did.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Okay.
And in fact, I wouldn't say that. I mean, my opinion is that it's not shoddy work. It's just incomplete work. And unfortunately, what was left out turns out to be a very critical piece of the puzzle. So I think it was an error and something that I don't understand. I'm hoping that Dr. G, during rebuttal, will be able to come and explain herself.
Well, I had one other question, actually, Michelle, and then I do have to go because I'm working on a memo. But, Larry, a lot of people ask me this, and I don't know the answer. Could they have tested her bones for chlorine?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I would think that chlorine, you're talking about a drowning, of course.
Correct. I'm talking about the drowning.
The Anthony's have a non-chlorine pool.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Is that true? Oh.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What was
the
that
Anthony's
about a tool?
Anthony's pool does not use chlorine. It's a non-chlorine pool.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So
that's interesting.
So that ends that.
Okay.
Okay.
I can tell you that there are other ways to tell about drowning, because pools generally use a diatomaceous filter. These tiny little microscopic diatoms are heated and in a solid block, but as the water filters through this filter, small diatoms are released, and again, it's quite possible that if somebody drowned, these diatoms might end up in the bloodstream and in the bone marrow. Failure to find it wouldn't mean she wasn't drowned, however. And we don't know what the level of diatoms were free-floating in the pool. So this is by no means the answer to the puzzle, but it's just an interesting piece of information.
Plus, her body was underwater when the area flooded where she was. It flooded from the rains on August 19th.
Correct, but I wouldn't expect diatoms in that type of water.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
do you have any other input for this coming week? I know that we made predictions last night, but obviously we were on a runaway train today. So,
Well, I still think William Rodriguez will be up next, because I do think the defense wants to put the witnesses on in the order they originally intended to call them, which is Rodriguez and then Eichenblum. So more forensics tomorrow, assuming all the depositions, everything was taken care of today, and I hope it was. I know that they have Roy Kronk under subpoena. I know that Vasco Thompson, that man who emerged last week, who showed up, his phone number showed up on George Anthony's phone records from the day before the Kaylee was reported missing. He's the convicted felon.
Mm-hmm.
He is scheduled to be deposed by the defense Wednesday, I think Wednesday after court. And I learned that from his attorney, because he was at our trailer at the compound across from the courthouse tonight.
Before you go, can I just, Beth, one thing? I think Beth pointed something out. I don't know if the listeners caught it. She said that there's no state but Florida that requires depositions prior to trial testimony. And I know I've testified in a number of states, and a report is not even required. If you've written something, that's part of discovery. But this restriction of testimony being directly related to the depositions is something unique in this courtroom. And I'm not even sure if other trials in Florida have the same exact rule. It's kind of surprising to me, because once you get on the stand, my understanding is that you can talk about anything related to your expertise. Once you're established as an expert, you can render an opinion. Now, this judge has made the decision that that will not happen. If it's not in the deposition, you can't testify to it. This is very, very unusual. One of a kind. So
it is,
Beth,
Larry, and the law in Florida does not require a report to be written by the defense experts, for example, but this judge required it.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so he
absolutely
did take it a step, and he wanted the basis for it in the report, so it could be fully deposed. He didn't want any surprises. He didn't want any glitches
right
at the trial, and it happened anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. He did take it further than the law requires here.
Right.
But depositions in criminal cases is pretty unique to Florida.
Right. And one last question, Beth. What was Judge Perry's position, job, before he became a judge?
He was an assistant state attorney.
So he was a prosecutor.
Yes.
I see.
In fact, he...
That helps.
Wasn't he the prosecutor that prosecuted Vasco Thompson?
Well,
no.
I guess that's why I asked
wait a minute. I think he might have been.
He was.
Yes, I think he was.
Yes, I think he might have been. Oh, that ought to be interesting. If Thompson actually makes it into court, I don't think he will, though.
Do you find that all of you that are on the call tonight, do you find that there are so many, it's almost like a family tree of how things connect. It's like I try to sit here and think, how stupid can an attorney be to not check sources about this Vasco guy, to assume that he was calling George, and now he is represented by the same people that represented Zenaida Gonzalez. It just seems like 6 degrees of separation here.
Yeah, but it's a small city. This wouldn't happen in New York City. I mean, chances are it wouldn't happen in New York City or even Miami.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, thank you, Beth. We'll be watching you all week. You're doing a wonderful job out there in Orlando, and definitely should be interesting come tomorrow morning and the demeanors of everybody in that courtroom.
Great. Well, thanks for inviting me, and we'll chat again and enjoy the rest of your discussion. I'm sure it will be very enlightening.
I'm sure.
Thank you so much again, Beth.
You have a good night.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Now, I want to dive into the forensics, because you had mentioned a few things, Dr. Kobolinski, and so did Beth. In regards to the reporting, I'm trying to understand how reports from Dr. Lee, yourself, the witnesses on both sides of the courtroom, isn't there a protocol of how one does a report? One would assume that somebody like Dr. Spitz would know how to do a report Why did we hear the prosecution making crude remarks at the fact that these were incomplete reports?
Well, that's a very good question, Michelle. And the simple answer is that there's no one right way to write a report, period. In other words, there's no standard for a report from an expert. Obviously, you should have in the report every bit of information from the time you became involved in the case, what your assumptions are, you know, all the details to identify what it is you've looked at, what experimentation you did, what conclusions you drew, and why you drew those conclusions. As much information as you can put in, including graphics, photography, whatever. But there's nothing that says, you know, it's got to be A, B, C, D, E, or it's not sufficient. And in fact, I think some experts prefer to put less in the report, whereas others prefer to put more in the report. So there's just no right or wrong here.
Now, when you are hired by either the defense or the state,
mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you this. Do experts who are witnesses for either side, are they paid by both prosecution, the state, and the defense, depending on who brought you in?
Well, you know, the state has access to various governmental laboratories and experts, law enforcement. The number of resources are extraordinary, whereas the defense doesn't have that privilege, even though the experts working in a government lab are supposed to be neutral and provide as much support for the defense as for the prosecution. It just doesn't work that way. And so the defense ends up having to hire their own independent experts. And if the defendant is indigent, then the experts must be paid out of whatever the state's laws or whatever the statutes are for support of indigent defendants. So it can be very lopsided because, again, the state has unlimited resources, and where they need more and they don't have it, they can call in government agencies like the FBI or any other federal agency. Whereas, again, you know, the FBI is a law enforcement agency, investigative and law enforcement. So the defense doesn't have the same options as the state does.
So whether and I want to walk through this process, and then we'll go to the learning curve, where we'll bring Shelley into this. In this, let's use this case as an example. She hires all of you. All of you make different amounts. I'm sure that Dr. Huntington doesn't get $5,000 a day, as we just heard on one of the shows regarding Dr. Spitz.
Yeah.
Now, you all were called to come in. You came in around the same time the remains were found, not
mm-hmm.
identified, but were found. And I recall on that Saturday how all of you went down to the scene and Geraldo had you on his show. And Dr. Spitz came out and said, "This is the first time in 50 years that I have been denied access to the scene of the crime that I have to investigate. This is ridiculous." Is that a true statement?
Well, you know, here's the problem. The evidence obviously is collected by law enforcement, and it becomes part of the prosecution's tools to develop their case. But obviously, after the analysis, the question is what about the defense? In other words, there are safeguards on certain items. Let's say, for example, you're looking at a bloodstain, and the state develops a certain information from that bloodstain. They are required to keep half of that evidentiary material to give to the defense so that they can do an independent examination. Now, the problem with the skeletal remains at the crime scene is that once it's disturbed And I don't mean that in a negative connotation, but once things are moved around, the defense can no longer view it in that state. So Dr. Spitz ended up doing an autopsy at a funeral parlor, whereas the state had access to the crime scene. So again, you know, that makes it very difficult for the defense to balance out in an equal way what the state is doing.
So then how does the state come back and when they're doing cross-examination on their on the defense's experts, how can they say you based your opinion on a photograph?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
they
didn't have
way.
Hardcore evidence to be able to get in there to examine the scene of the crime and the status of how the remains were found,
yeah.
What direction, everything else. So everything on the defense side had to be examined through photographs and testimony compared to actual site. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. And
so how can he fight something that he prevented from happening?
Yeah, it's one-sided. And okay. Dr. Spitz, the best he can do is do that second autopsy and generate information. But he obviously is at a very big disadvantage with respect to the crime scene. All he can do is look at the documentation and listen to the testimony and see if it fits together. I mean, unfortunately, the system is not it's not even on both sides. That's just the way it is sometimes. But again, this is a capital case, and we want to play fair. And both sides should have equal access.
So if the defense, there were what, five or six of you from bug experts to forensics to, I think Linda Kenny-Bodden was here at that time. All of you were denied access until the scene was completely cleaned up, if you will, shrubbery cut, rake, whatever the case may be, nothing was left there when you guys got in. Is it a normal scene to have you denied access?
Well,
however, lay folks like Tim Miller's from Texas Equisearch would be allowed access to that site upon the remains being found?
Yeah, Michelle, let me first just make something clear. I did not actually go down with the team to look at the evidence, look at the vehicle. I have seen documentation of the scene and studied the photographs and studied the vehicle based on photographs. I was not part of that. But I think you're raising a very, very important point. And I would say, you know, most major cases are like that because defense attorneys are generally, they don't come into the picture until, you know, the person is brought to court, the defendant is brought to court, and, you know, there's an arraignment and all of that, and the legal procedure kicks in. At that point, there needs to be an attorney brought in, and then the question is the experts. So it doesn't happen until later on. So this is not that unusual, but the result is it is uneven because it's true the defense experts just don't see the crime scene as it originally existed. That's why documentation is so critical. Whether it's photography, videotape, sketches, aerial photographs, whatever you could imagine, documentation is the only way the defense experts can actually look at that crime scene in its original state.
Okay, and Shelley, let me ask you as a professor, do you all teach your students protocol of when they get a call to go to a crime scene and the do's and don'ts?
There are definitely classes that we teach, such as crime scene procedure, which kind of puts it all in a nutshell, but every class kind of fits together for a common aim at what they should do at scenes. However, to date, there are no set standards to become a crime scene investigator. Different departments hire differently. Some departments have sworn officers that kind of take some classwork and then go into the field of crime scene investigation, where other departments, such as Orange County Sheriff's Office, have civilians that, and I believe, and I stand corrected if I'm wrong, but I believe for Orange County Sheriff's Office, you have to have a high school diploma and some months of experience, and there are civilians that just step into that field and have on-the-job training. So every crime scene is different, but as far as standards for crime scene investigators, there's no set standards. There is an organization, International Association of Identification, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Dr. Podolinsky.
Sure.
And they do trainings, and they are trying to get standardized with a crime scene investigator test, which some departments require and some don't. But to date, there is no set standard on what you need to become a crime scene investigator and what you need to do. And I don't know that they'll ever, I mean, we teach what needs to be done at a crime scene and, you know, preserving evidence and chain of custody and things like that. But each crime scene is so different that no one ever knows what they're going to come upon, you know, when they get to that specific crime scene.
So do you all teach when an autopsy is performed? Is it typical to have the skull open?
I personally have been to many, 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 possibly hundreds of autopsies, and every time I was at an autopsy, the skull was open, and whatever was inside was removed, weighed, and samples were taken, and that was in the state of Florida. To me, that was standard protocol. I mean, we could obviously, when we would go to the medical examiner's office, we would be able to see the entrance wound. We would be able to see the exit wound. We would know that, you know, they open the chest cavity first with the Y incision and break open the rib, and we could obviously see where the gunshot went through the heart. However, they still opened the skull. They saw the skull open and removed the brain. So,
and I would think that would count too on child abuse, that in reality, if this was an accident, as the defense has claimed, count two, I would think opening that you would have seen if Kaylee had suffered at the hands of her mother or anybody else for that matter over the course of time prior to the death and the accident. Is that correct? Like fractures, things of that nature? Either one of you?
I would agree. If there were old wounds healing, you might be able to see that with your eyes, with x-rays. Certainly there's information that is lost if you do not do the procedure completely and from top to bottom and front to back. It's a very extensive procedure, and it's really a matter of what's done in this country typically, and the removing of the cranium is quite typical and standard procedure.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hearing, but it's sure hard when you're sitting back watching the case unfold, the trial, where both sides are disagreeing with each other. And it's like if you both, you know, both sides are experts in the same field, it's like, holy cow, if I was a juror, I'd be saying, who do I believe?
Well, that's precisely the point. I'm sure Shelley would agree with me. Two people can look at the same evidence and have different explanations for what they're looking at. I mean, some things are indisputable, but for the most part, people do come up with different spins or different approaches to their interpretation of the evidence. So they say evidence never lies. Perhaps that's true, but it can be interpreted in different ways by people on opposite sides. This is an adversarial system, and that's what we have in this country in the courts. We have experts that work for both sides, and you will get completely diametrically different opinions. Given the same information, the duct tape, you heard Werner Spitz, I mean, and you heard Dr. G. And I think there really raises reasonable doubt.
I did comment on your posting on In Session on Beth's survey mm-hmm. today, Doctor.
Yeah.
I made a comment under yours too, because what gets me is Dr. G primarily was, in my opinion, based a lot on her opinion of, well, any child with duct tape on them, to me that's 100% murder.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can you make that kind of a statement when you're a medical examiner and you can't find a stitch of DNA or tissue or anything other than some hair that doesn't account for the as much hair as she had? How can you account for that and make that kind of a comment? How can you, Dr. Kobolinski?
This is a very,
because
very
I've
good
had
question.
You on a few times now, and we always come back to that and that duct
right.
tape.
Yeah.
There is no DNA on it. There's nothing.
Right.
There's nobody else's DNA but an FBI agent. So
exactly.
How in the world
exactly.
can they prove that anybody put duct tape on this child? And then try to trace it back to George Anthony.
Well, duct tape is not that unusual at certain crime scenes. Duct tape is used to bind victims. It's used to seal plastic bags in which there is evidence or body parts or whole victims. In this case, Werner Spitz, I think, suggested that the duct tape may have been applied long after Kaylee died, and that might have been to hold the mandible, to hold the jaw, together with the rest of the skull. But I think, if you listen carefully, I think people were saying that the duct tape was found in the vicinity of the lower part of the front of the skull, not adherent, not attached, and as Werner Spitz said, there's no evidence that it was placed on premortem, perimortem, but the likelihood is that it was long after postmortem, and so that raises issues that the defense will certainly take advantage of.
Dr. Kobolinski, he did say that it was postmortem. However, if it was pre-decom, then wouldn't you suspect that there would be some type of skin cell or DNA on there?
Well, again, you have to remember, yes, the answer is yes, but you have to remember that, the environment can be very detrimental to finding biological evidence. We know that sunlight can destroy the ability to amplify DNA. It creates what we call dimers in some of the base units, the thymine base pairs in DNA. And of course, cells can be disrupted because of environmental conditions, very hot, very humid, water. I can see both sides of the issue. Where's the DNA? Maybe it was there, but it's not there anymore. It's a very complicated issue, and we don't have all the answers. But one thing that Werner Spitz says is, from what I heard, is that failure to find this material, no fingerprints, no DNA, no cellular material, only hair, it certainly is consistent with very long after she died, post-decomposition.
Right.
So post, okay, go ahead.
Post-decomposition. Okay, let me ask you about the DNA that they're saying they got from the remains. If I read correctly, they got the DNA, Dr. G cut out a rectangular part of her right tibia. and sent it off to the FBI. And I'm not suggesting anything here. I'm just asking, and because cases that I've seen have been done differently, the autopsy report just has a blurb with Dr. G saying that right tibia DNA matched that of Kaylee Marie Anthony, which is very similar to what she said on her interview, which was on December 19th, I think, which is very familiar with what she said. That I have yet
her press conference.
Press conference, yes. I have yet to see the DNA actual report with the markers and the genetic markings and any of that. And I was wondering, that's common for me in court to see those DNA reports, not just the medical examiner's blurb.
Absolutely.
What do you think?
Absolutely,
yeah. Okay.
Correct. You know, as a DNA expert, I do a large number of homicide rape cases in the New York metropolitan tri-state area, and routinely I will get the reports that are produced by various crime labs or the medical examiner's office. That is really the foundation. Without that, I simply can't accept a final report that says, yes, it's
right.
This is the person. I need to see the data. And then I look at the bench notes, the lab notes, to see how that conclusion was reached, so that you follow chain of custody, you follow procedures, and you see exactly what occurred in the laboratory. I think that's – I mean, I always tell attorneys, if they didn't give it to you, you go, you get a subpoena from the judge, and you get that material, because again, you're on the defense. You don't have all the records. If you're gonna, you know, you can't make any assumptions here. You've got to look at the hard data, and so that's my own experience.
And
we have a couple people in the chat room weighing in. Just a reminder, the call-in number for any questions to Dr. Kobolinsky and Shelley Schaefer is 347-838-8622. They're going pretty quick here, but let me do you think there are fingerprints on bed sheets? Can you get fingerprints off of bed sheets or a blanket?
Oh my goodness, Shelley. Let me take this, and then maybe you can knock it around a little bit.
I think fingerprints.
Very seldom can you get usable information bearing fingerprints off of that type of material, off of fabrics and the like. I mean, there are a lot of publications that demonstrate how you can retrieve fingerprints from all sorts of substrates, from wood to leather to metals to all kinds of things. But the reality is sometimes you can't do it, and you'd be surprised. On a gun, for example, on the grip of a gun, people would love to get fingerprints because, you know, people are charged with criminal possession of a weapon. They can't get fingerprints because it's just the substrate is not amenable. So the answer is almost always no.
What about garbage bags and a canvas bag?
Well, if I can just go on the back of Dr. Kobolinsky. On the garbage bags, it is possible. I think what people want to see the fingerprints on is the tape. And what it comes down to is it comes down to a porous or non-porous material. And if we have a non-porous material, which is a non-absorbent material, something flat, something like glass, something like the garbage bag, we can use cyanoacrylate, which is simply the technical term for superglue. The black trash bags, there could have been fingerprints. There are different technologies, different chemicals, different procedures. With the duct tape, there is even a special procedure that is called sticky side tape, which will help you get fingerprints off of substances like duct tape, electrical tape, things like that. You know, fingerprints, even if they're in water, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Kobolinsky, even if they're in water, they're not going to go away. They basically have to be rubbed away. So if I touch, and I know it's not the same material, but if I touch a beer bottle today and put fingerprints and then I throw it in the canal behind my house, And then I go and get it in 6 months after it dries, I should be able to still get those fingerprints. They might not be as clear and as identifiable, but I should still be able to get it. It needs to be wiped away. So, you know, depending on what the FBI did, because they're the ones that had most of the evidence in collecting fingerprints, there are certain ways to get fingerprints off of different both porous and non-porous substances.
So how do you explain the fact that from the get-go, there is no fingerprints or DNA of George, Casey, Cindy, and Lee that we have been told about, and the state has rest their case? How do you explain not in the trunk? You don't have anything on two plastic bags. You don't have anything on a canvas bag. You don't show any dirt whatsoever on the car, in the car, on the shoes, on the clothes, the Gatorade bottle, on the needle, inside the Gatorade bottle, on the skeleton, on anything, the duct tape, anything. How does one explain that, Dr. Kobylinski, when, again, we are trying a capital case here,
right,
and I know the world hates Casey Anthony,
mm-hmm,
but in the end, if this was your child,
mm-hmm,
and your family going through this, how would you explain all of that?
First of all, I think you're right. I do think the whole world hates Casey, and that's why I asked the question earlier, is there not a presumption of innocence until proven guilty? We haven't even finished the trial yet, but people are ready to hang her.
And I
so
think they hate her more because of her defense attorney now.
I think so. But, you know, she's entitled to the best defense that science can give. Any defendant should be entitled to a solid scientific defense. And then if she's found guilty thereafter, that's another issue. But, I mean, you know, the state's trying to take her life. And in my opinion, not all of their science is totally reliable. And it's disturbing. Anyway, getting back to the issue about how why is it that all of this material, you can't find any fingerprints? I mean, the obvious answer is that whoever did this wore gloves. And therefore,
what about DNA, though?
Well,
I mean, you would think that, you know, throwing a body into a trunk with a bunch of chloroform and all of that, your hair would fall off. You know, I mean, you flip your head over and a bunch of hair falls out. The mud, they looked at 22 pairs of shoes and clothing and everything in that house. Even the mud in the tire tracks did not match the mud over in that area. How is that explained? And I didn't hear the state bring it into evidence. So,
well, I think that's exactly what this fellow Eichenblum was supposed to be discussing for the defense. The reality is that DNA is a very, very sturdy material. It's far, far more hardy than proteins or carbohydrates or lipids. In other words, it sticks around a long, long time. In fact, if it's preserved properly, you can do DNA on mummies and archaeological specimens. And old cases that are 30 and 40 years old, you can still do DNA. But when it's exposed to certain environmental insults, whether it's high temperatures or humidity or bacterial contamination, things of that sort, you can degrade DNA to the point where there's nothing left to test. Look at the World Trade Center, the 9/11 samples in New York City. You know, a lot of people have been identified, but there are a lot of people that haven't. And that's, you know, there are many thousands of pieces of physical evidence that's never been successfully DNA typed. And that has a lot to do with the high temperatures that these materials were exposed to. So you don't always see DNA on a case. Most of the time you do. But when you're dealing with very harsh conditions, sometimes you just don't.
And what about the DNA as far as, I know that chloroform was a question also. They said there was a lot of chloroform in the trunk of the car. Wouldn't that chloroform transfer onto the garbage bag that was thrown in the dumpster and then later brought into evidence?
Well, chloroform is volatile. And, you know, if it's exposed to the air long enough, it will vaporize. It's gone. Would it adhere to the plastic bag? I suppose it would depend what if that bag was, you know, in the open environment or if it was in a sealed container like a trunk. Obviously, the carpeting had some substance in there. I mean, the quantity of chloroform is apparently in dispute. It was detected by both states' experts. So I don't know that there's a question about the presence of chloroform. It's the quantity that I think is an issue.
So with back to the question on DNA, if let's say Kaylee's in the bag, she accidental death or murder, however, in one garbage bag, double bagged into a second, into a canvas bag, even though it may be ripped a little bit, when she would start to decompose all her fluids, wouldn't there be leftover DNA somewhere that a swab could pick up throughout those three bags?
I would expect that, yes. I think decomposition, it takes time to go through the complete sequence of events. When you end up in the advanced decomposition state with skeletonization, you still have DNA within the bones, and you have DNA within hair, but the soft tissue is gone, and so, you know, DNA goes with it.
But no chloroform or Xanax within the hair strands that they did find?
No, the toxicology report.
Would you have found it in there if she was being put under those methods?
I would think so.
Okay, we have a caller from the
81.
Say that again.
The tox report was negative.
Okay. We have a caller from 810. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Why haven't they brought up the argument on July 15th?
We would have to have Ashton or Baez on the call for that. I have no idea.
But wouldn't it make sense to you to bring that up? That's what leads people to believe that it wasn't an act. She gets in an argument with her mother. Next day she accidentally drowns. Does that make sense to anybody?
Well, and I'm not an attorney. It's a little odd, but if we look at the entire case, and I think, you know, we're just talking about forensics here, but if you look at the entire case, and if you've been watching any of it, we find the entire case a little odd, don't you?
Every day.
So obviously, who knows why they haven't brought that up. It is strange, you know.
Yeah, it seems to me that would tell you that it wasn't an accident because the timing, it just doesn't make sense.
I would agree with you. The timing doesn't make any sense. However, playing devil's advocate, like I tend to do on this show, if she had a big fight, as we have heard from witnesses, on the 15th, and she leaves with Kaylee, she comes back on the 16th to pack a bag, that would not imply that she was setting out to murder her child, and George was at the house until 3 o'clock that day, and then she rented Blockbuster at 7 o'clock in the evening on that same date. That would give her four or five hour window to do a crime, and if she's done a crime, I would surmise that, and Dr. Kobolinski, correct me if I'm wrong, but to pull off the perfect crime, one doesn't do it in a very rushed situation.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, there's a lot of bizarre behavior on the part of Casey Anthony that I don't think anybody will ever understand.
Why
she lies the way she does and fantasizes. I mean, this is a real case for a forensic psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
but I just want to make it clear that, you know, I'm not a spokesperson for the defense. I'm just talking about the science and my own perception of certain things. So I do agree that this is bizarre behavior.
Can I say something else? On the 16th is when Cindy found out or noticed that the ladder had been moved, which I believe it was around 7:30. It's a heck of a coincidence, and now they're claiming 3 years later, 2.5 years later, she accidentally drowned in the pool.
Well, there's a lot of coincidences in this case. I mean, besides for the fact that there's no forensics to prove that a crime has been committed, whether accidental or murder, there's a lot of speculation and coincidences in regards. Don't get me wrong, like Dr. Kobolinski said, this is going to take a long time to figure out Casey Anthony. However, I'd like to know, personally, why it is that every time a bounty hunter would say something on television before anybody else would say it, it would come true. I would like to know that. And a lot of the evidence that we've heard about an argument on Father's Day and the ladder being moved and all of that, that comes from a bounty hunter that was in the house for 2 hours.
Cindy
did notice the ladder was moved, but I have a 2.5-year-old niece, and I can tell you, if she knows she needs to put on her life preserver, she's going to do so. So I wouldn't be a good juror for the defense at this point, because I don't believe that there was a drowning, because that little girl was very articulate and knew her rights and wrongs, and before putting up a ladder and climbing into a pool, she would have put on her life preserver. She did not do that. That was not found. So I would say that I'm not a fan of the defense's theory that there was a drowning, because the first time you heard about a drowning came from Leonard Padilla and how chloroform can be made by a diaper full of chlorine. Does chlorine cause chloroform, Dr. Kobolinski?
Yes, absolutely correct.
Yes.
Now, that would be assuming that a child had a diaper on. Kaylee Anthony was potty trained and did not wear a diaper. So how do you dispute that? But it came from Leonard Padilla, so I guess it must be right.
Well, but that was the first thing that struck me, is when Cindy made the comment that the ladder had been moved. I didn't know what day it was. That was my first thought. She drowned her baby, because I knew about the argument. Okay? I knew there was some form of an argument. It just makes sense to me that the next day your daughter doesn't accidentally drown after you get in a physical altercation with your mom. But another thing, I just lost my train of thought. Going to say it was a drowning. I believe it from 3 years ago. It was a drowning. It shocked me that they even said that that's how she died, but to say it was an accident didn't wasn't surprising at all. People keep talking about what couldn't find in the vehicle, but they don't mention, nobody mentions that the mother admitted to cleaning the vehicle. And I'm not thinking she just vacuumed it. She actually cleaned it with cleaners that, when mixed together, chloroform. I found out on the internet. So that would explain the chloroform.
Yeah, somebody's saying also, Dr. Kobolinski, that on Nancy Grace, you had mentioned chlorine could cause chloroform. But then we had a caller tonight say there was no chlorine in the Anthony's pool, so I guess that throws that theory out of the water too, pardon the pun.
Well, what I said on Nancy Grace's program was that you could take bleach, which is a hypochlorite, a substance which contains the chlorine atom, and combine that with either nail polish, acetone, or alcohol, and that will form chloroform. So it's not just chlorine in a pool. What I was trying to explain is that chloroform can form innocently. But I find it interesting that this caller pointed out that Cindy used various cleaning agents to clean the trunk and could have incorporated chloroform that way. I don't know. But
well,
that's
I think Baez mentioned Febreze.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, again,
and if
the
I'm correct, if I'm correct, not positive, I'm not a chemist, but I believe Febreze does not have chloroform in it. I would have to.
I would hope not, because we use it all over this house.
Thank you for taking the question.
The reason I was saying that was because the theory about the pool, which at the first time we heard it, came from Leonard Padilla on Nancy Grace.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so the child drowned. It was a cover-up. That, to me, is ludicrous to think that anyone would cover up this child's death. But, okay, so be it. But now we had a caller early on the show call and say, and we're going to ask the Anthonys at some point, the pool had no chlorine. I've never seen a pool without chlorine unless it's a baby's pool. So, and I know their pool had a pump, so I would surmise it had chlorine. But if it didn't, that takes away that theory. So, and everything comes back to chemicals and science.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in this case, doesn't it?
I would agree.
Because none of the science is adding up to the character assassination done on somebody's character. I grant you, she's weird, she's mean to her family, she lies, she steals, you know, all of that stuff. But that still doesn't make somebody a murderer. But however, if she covered up a murder or covered up an accident, my question then is, what kind of an attorney does she have? Because why would you wait 3 years to have your day in court if you knew that was the situation? Why wouldn't you just plea it out? She had a plea on the table for 10 years and didn't take it. That makes
sense. That's a good question.
It makes no sense. And usually people that last 3 years without pleading out after being offered a plea deal 3 times, and the death sentence has been on the table twice now. This is the second time. It was taken off the table at one point. And never to say that you've done harm to your daughter, you either really believe in your defense attorney, or maybe you just didn't do a crime. But that's my opinion. Because the science is just not making any sense to me, and I'm a big fan of forensics and DNA. I'm a huge fan of that, and I truly believe when you look around your own house, you look around your own car, there is so much DNA we leave behind every single day, and to think that not one person in that family can be traced back to the location that the remains were found, that doesn't make
Lockhart's,
any sense to me.
Lockhart's principle of exchange, right, Dr. Kobolinski? Whenever two objects come in contact, Lockhart's principle of exchange is what she's speaking of. However, we just can't find it in this case scientifically, and there's so much else surrounding the case that you just don't even know where to look for the science or the transference of the evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I would
agree.
Why
aren't you
going
to be a witness, Dr. Kobolinski?
I made a decision early on. I have a lot going on in my personal life. I'm juggling probably 30 or 40 very, very major cases here in New York. I'm on jury duty, believe it or not, last week and this week as a telephone juror, so I'm waiting to be called to federal court. And there's a lot going on in my life having to do with my college as well, and I knew the timing was not going to work out. So I spoke to Jose Baez a while back, and I indicated that I would have some problems, time-wise, personal issues involving testimony.
Do you, in regards to the cases that you're doing in New York, do you find that a lot of the time you're brought onto a case and yet you can never figure out why there's a lack of DNA to prove somebody's guilt?
Well, no. The answer is absolutely no, and the reason is simply because when I become involved in the case, it's after the state has done their analysis and come up with DNA that looks, you know, that supports their case. I've then come in and then look at the case independently. So all of these cases already have DNA. It is true that occasionally there are cases that I'm involved with where there is no finding of DNA, but those are far and few. You know, very few cases are like that. But I gave you the example of a gun where you can't find fingerprints on the grip because of the texture, yet you can find DNA. So it's an important piece of information, evidence, very often, but sometimes you just don't have it. And this, you know, this Casey Anthony case is one in which there is no significant DNA except for the contaminant.
Shelley?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you were weighing in. I'm sorry.
Oh.
In this particular case, how many experts on both sides? Because we had learned from day one that this was going to the slam dunk, if you will, the smoking gun, would be the forensics. And yet that's not what we're seeing in this case. Do you think that's because of the delivery of the defense team opposed to not being able to get the things in because they neglected to meet deadlines and such?
Well, you know,
perhaps
it's
what
it's,
they
it's,
meant.
Yeah, sorry. Shelley, go ahead.
I'm sorry, too. Perhaps what they meant by the forensics being the smoking gun, maybe they were talking about the lack of forensics being the smoking gun. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know. But maybe we missed. Or you know, maybe the public misunderstood. But go ahead, Doctor. I'm sorry about that.
Well, I think the state is trying to sell their case by saying there's a mountain of physical evidence. And they're talking about the chemistry, the air sampling, the chloroform, the hair, the autopsy. You know, they're saying that it all adds up. I think one of the callers said, you've got to look at the whole picture. And if you look at the whole picture, you know, you see the defendant and you can make some decisions. I think what the defense is doing is trying to whittle away that each item has a problem. And if each item has a problem, then you can't add everything up and come to a conclusion. I think it's a strategy, a defense strategy of pointing out issues and problems with the forensic case that the state has put together. I mean, quite frankly, I think that some of the evidence that the state has brought forward, and I've said this before, I think there are issues about whether or not this stuff is reliable. That should have been looked at in a Frey hearing and kept out if it was deemed unreliable. You know, this is not the time to bring in so-called state-of-the-art science. This is a capital case. This needs validated, reliable science. And so, you know, the state wants to win this case at all costs, no matter what. And that's not what this is about. This is about justice and finding out the truth. And if that's really the aim, then why not? Why use technicalities to prevent defense experts from saying what they think, rendering their opinion? Are we going to stop their discussion or rendering an opinion because of a technicality, because of this issue involving depositions and reports, which is only an issue in this courtroom and no place else in the country? It just seems to me that the defendant should be entitled to have her experts say what they think, and then let the jury decide.
Well, the same goes for the prosecution.
Yes, absolutely. Everybody should have an opinion and let them talk. As long as it's based on reliable science, they should they should render an opinion.
So let's talk about Dr. Huntington just for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
He was sworn in. The prosecution declared him an expert and said, oh, by all means, you know, he has, you know, raving credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of it, he was tearing the kid up on the stand saying he wasn't an expert, basically in so many words, and tearing up the way he did his research in order to see if the findings were the same, and with a pig no less. I think many people, I think this is where a lot of the fighting continues between the defense and the prosecution. When you've got a prosecutor there that is so drawn to making sure justice prevails for this baby girl,
right,
Kaylee Marie, and you've got somebody there that's going to now be sarcastic and demeaning in his approach with an expert witness about a pig in a blanket.
Absolutely.
And then turn around and say, I told you I was going to say it.
Mm-hmm.
That's out of spite. That reminds me of something a bounty hunter once did. So to me, you're trying to prosecute this case, and that is how you're making your defense?
Yeah, I got
to
tell you.
That's appalling to me.
Michelle.
And everyone looked at Casey by saying, you know, oh, look, she was smirking. But everybody in the courtroom was making a joke out of it, and I thought that was disgusting.
I have to tell you, I was listening to the trial and listening to Mr. Ashton talk about a pig in a blanket, and I shuddered. I could not believe what I was hearing in a case like this with such a horrendous death of a two-year-old and an expert raising issues within his expertise, and using the only thing he could use to do his work, namely a pig. Pigs are used very often by forensic scientists because there are a lot of characteristics that are similar to humans. And for him to raise that issue as a pig in a blanket, I was not just appalled, I was shocked. And other people in the courtroom laughed. They thought that was humorous. But it shows you what's going on in that courtroom and the approach used by the prosecution.
But he just didn't just breeze over it either. He had to make a point to tell Linda Burdick that, I told you I was going to say it.
Yeah.
We needed some laughter in here.
Yeah, I thought that was just
appalling. And no wonder these two men are going at it. And, you know, this is another life here that they're one's saving and one's trying to kill.
Right.
And yet that's the kind of drama going on in this courtroom. I think that's appalling.
It's shocking. It's amazing. They want to win this case at all costs. The defense is trying to save a life. You know, I think if they talk about sanctions, I think with a remark like that, if anybody should be sanctioned, it should be the prosecution for making a crude remark like that.
How do you think that witness did? He's young. Everyone, all the news media was calling him the student with the professor.
Yeah.
Because I thought he was obviously very much into bugs.
Yes.
But I think besides being a tad bit boring, he was making perfect sense at the fact that how did you only have one blowfly leg? That hundreds should have been, their legs should have been left.
Right.
You know, so he was making sense, and then all of a sudden the prosecutor came, and yes, despite the fact that he's supposed to prosecute the case, the witnesses are not the ones on trial, and yet to try to discredit an expert is very sad in my book, because how many more people will ever want to testify?
Well, let me just tell you, I've met Tim several times. He is a scholar. He's an academic. He's bright. I trust his comments. He doesn't exaggerate. He's very careful. He's articulate. I also listened to Neil Haskell, whom, you know, I know from the Academy, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. I think if you match them point by point, I would go with Tim. even though Tim was his student, there are times when students excel over their professors. I know many of my students who are now leaders in their fields have gone way beyond where I have gotten to. And this is an example of where the defense has an excellent expert. I think trying to create a problem in the eyes of the jury by attacking his credibility. I mean, this is what prosecutors do. I mean, defense attorneys do that also, to try to discredit experts on the opposite side. But, you know, what they have to look at is not his age. They have to obviously look at his experience and his knowledge and his training and his education and all of that. But I mean, I think everything he said was well thought out and based on scientific principles. That's the key. Based on scientific principles, not guesstimating. I think Neil Haskell basically said something very convenient, that the entomology made it look like the postmortem interval was about 6 months, which is just very consistent with the state's case. I mean, where's the real scientific foundation for that, or was it an estimate that happened to sound very much aligned with the state's case? I think Tim did a great job, and it's just unfortunate that he was attacked the way he was.
I have a question for you, Doctor. Go ahead, Shelley.
I have a question for you, and I'm not too clear on the dates, but I know there was somewhere around the 18th, Kaylee had come home, and George went out to the garage and wanted his gas cans. She didn't let him get the gas cans, but she gave him the gas cans and said some words to him. But he did not smell anything. And
right.
Then the car was left at the Amscot. The Amscot manager did not smell anything. And then the
Tony Lazzaro didn't
smell
anything.
Yes, Tony Lazzaro didn't smell anything. And then the tow truck driver came, and he didn't smell anything. And it wasn't until the car was picked up, but that goes from the 16th to the 30th, and in 90-degree weather in a trunk in Florida, I think you're going to smell something before 2 weeks.
Shelley, that's great point, absolutely great point. I think we really need to see a timeline, what the state is alleging with the timeline, or the same thing for the defense, and to see what is more consistent with those comments that you just made. That was very, very astute and I think correct.
Thank you.
So where do you think, what are we going to see this week, Dr. Kobylinski?
Well, I think we're going to see more in the way of experts, but I, quite frankly, I'm worried right now, only in that this severe restriction that's being placed on experts, they are not going to be at liberty to speak out on their opinions. They are going to read a script, and perhaps, they will be able to expand a little bit beyond the depositions, but I think that they are going to be very restricted from saying anything that's not in the depots. It is really unfortunate, because if we're really searching for justice, then they should be allowed to speak, and that's not going to happen. So I think we're going to hear about DNA, I'm not sure where it's going from there. There may be something more on the heart-shaped this adhesive on the duct tape. There may be something there. I'm not sure exactly where the defense is going to go for the rest of the week.
Do you think Cheney should be doing the rest of the trial from here on out?
I would agree with you, simply because Jose is really getting a hard time right now from the judge, and I think it would be in the interest of the defendant to have Cheney step up and do a little more of the cross-examination of the experts. I think the defense is still, you know, they're going to be subjected to scrutiny. I mean, I wish the judge had spoken up more when the state's case was on, but he's doing it now that the defense case is on. And it's really unfortunate because, you know, this is the time that, you know, experts have to speak up to provide an alternate explanation. And I just hate the fact that they're going to be so severely restricted.
What do you see her getting?
You mean in terms of if she's convicted?
Sentence, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think she's going to even be convicted of first degree. I think the issue is whether the second charge is going to carry, because that's a death penalty charge as well. So there are a lot of questions here.
A lot of questions.
I honestly don't know. But I would say this. I think if this jury's listening carefully, I think there could be a hung jury here.
You know, I asked Beth that today while she was on the air, and she responded, because I guess many people were asking, she doesn't see, you said hung jury. I asked her about a mistrial, but either way, the journalists don't seem to think, they think this is going to work its way through.
Well, we'll have to see. I think a lot of people
are
getting lined up now following deliberations. I think there's going to be a lot of coverage no matter what happens. But I think now that there has been so many questions raised, especially by Dr. Werner Spitz, as well as by Tim Huntington, I think there are going to be some jurors that may really have questions. And that should be the reasonable doubt. And I think it's very likely there'll be a hung jury.
Should interviewing, my last question, and then I know you have to go. And Shelley, if you have any last questions for Dr. Kobolinsky, I'll let you get those in. But if you can stay a little longer, Shelley, that would be great. Do you think that doing interviews and doing media blitzes and things of that nature should have even been brought up, considering both sides of that courtroom have been doing their fair share of interviews?
Well, you know, I have to understand that for almost 3 years now, the media has been beating the drum of this horrendous person, Casey. And the national audience now fully believes she's guilty of the most heinous crime imaginable. And I think that people are now ready to pull the plug on her. And this is before the trial is over.
You should see some of the websites.
Yeah, so I mean, when the media responds and says, no, we're fair, we're even, we're balanced, I think that's a bunch of nonsense. I think that even commentators that have been even and balanced on other cases are no longer that way. And I'm disappointed simply because if you're talking news, you should be fair and balanced. If you're talking entertainment, then go and do what you want. But it's just, you know, she needs a fair trial. You know, the only way that's going to happen is in a courtroom where the judge makes his decisions fairly, you know, and the gamesmanship stops and, you know, we get facts and the jury then will make up their mind if they can.
Shelley, do you have any questions for Dr. Kobolinsky? I know we've run over again. Time flies on this show.
It was great talking to you again, Doctor. And I just wanted to reiterate something that he had said earlier. I, as well, am not here talking that the defense and Casey is innocent and Casey is guilty. I'm just talking about the facts and the scientific facts and what I know of them. And I just wanted to reiterate that I agreed with him on that. I'm not pro anything. I just want to see justice for Kaylee.
And I completely agree with you. And I know I try to make that point many times when I do this show. But the show is about voices for justice and nothing more, nothing less. If Casey is proven to have done a crime and she's gotten a fair trial, then I'd be the first to convict her. but prove it to me first. And right now, if I was a juror, I would be not able to make that decision because nobody has proven one way or another except for she should have called 911. She, you know, shouldn't have written checks. She shouldn't have done this. She shouldn't have done that. But, you know, I can't convict a liar because a lot of people lie, you know. But show me the evidence that she's done a heinous crime like this to that beautiful child, I'll be the first to send her away. But I haven't been proven that yet. But Dr. Kobolinski, thank you so very much again. We love having you on, and I know that Beth feels the same way for you. So
thank you.
Hopefully
thank
we'll
you.
Have you back soon.
It's a real
and,
pleasure.
And thanks again. Shelley, we're going to, again, take a couple more questions if anyone has them. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. And for those that think that George, you know, may have covered something up, again, we'd like to play the voicemail message that he had on his cell phone while we were looking for Kaylee, and to answer the caller's previous question in the beginning of tonight's show, I don't regret trying to find a live child that her grandparents thought was missing. And until somebody proves that otherwise to me, that's the stand I'm going to take. But here's the call.
Missing child alert. Hi, this is George Anthony, grandfather of missing 2-year-old Kaylee Marie Anthony. She was last seen June 16, 2008. She's 3 feet tall, has big hazel eyes and brown hair. She could be anywhere. Please help me and my family bring her home for her 3rd birthday. Any information that you provide will be completely confidential and anonymous. There will be a $225,000 reward for information that leads to the safe return of Kaylee. Press 1 now to be connected to a live representative and help us bring Kaylee home. Or for more information, visit our website at www.helpfindkaylee.com or call 1-800-423-8477.
For some of you that are listening that are not in the chat room, some of the folks are posting some information in there. To clarify, John Morgan's client is Zenaida Gonzalez, not Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez. That is correct. And now Morgan's son, Matt, is representing Vasco, the gentleman that supposedly was called to testify because he was in contact with George. So this is like all the soap operas that went off the air this year. This is basically your fix because it's definitely definitely keeps you in tune every day. Shelley, let me ask you, as a professor of forensics, and I know that you've been teaching in Orlando and also in North Carolina. What do your classes think of this trial?
What I like to teach my students is I like to teach them to go in with an open mind because, you know, it's all about integrity in the police department, and I'm retired from the police department in South Florida. And it's all about integrity. And if you go in saying, she did it, then you know, there's going to be evidence that can be messed up or tampered with, or the chain of custody may not be preserved. So I try to teach them an open mind. We talk a lot about this case. And even here in North Carolina, where I am now, we talk a lot about this case. And after I show them some things, their minds start to open up and they start to think, yeah, how can that be? Yeah, that doesn't make sense. We have a lot of people that just think Kaylee is the worst person on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so for me personally, as I said, I'm not for the defense, but I don't think lying actually makes you a baby killer. We're looking at the evidence, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. And, you know, a lot of people's minds change, and a lot of people's minds don't, as far as students go, and even people that I just discussed the case with. But, you know, you have to have an open mind, and you have to see what the evidence says. You know, people lie, evidence doesn't.
So. That's a good point. Definitely a good point. A couple other comments in the neck breaking. Pimpkin, like your name. Neck breaking. That's interesting. You know, the searches that were done back in March of 2008 on neck breaking, chloroform, how to make it, all of that. I find it interesting that the witness for the prosecution, Ricardo Morales, who took the stand, that he found that chloroform, you know, killer, or what was it called? Killer with chloroform or something that he had on his MySpace. He found as funny. And he admitted to downloading it and putting it on his site. So, you know, as a juror, I would have liked to have seen the defense come back and kind of go down that line with that particular questioning as to, did you ever have access to Casey's computer? You know, because if you have somebody that has evidence that he's put that on his site, how do we know he didn't get it off of Casey's computer?
Well, and again, with that, and to my understanding of some reports that I've heard, and again, not protecting Casey, I heard that he sent that picture and killer with chloroform or something like that to Casey, and you know, and again, who knows? We do know there's been an awful lot of lies here, but.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently Casey didn't know that what chloroform was. So that was some of the searches.
And we don't know if she's telling the truth or not. I'm just making an observation that from my standpoint, March of 2008, when she first met Ricardo, I think in January or March, that, you know, he admitted he did that and downloaded it, and when asked why, it was like a smirk, like, oh, because I thought it was funny. How can you think that's funny? Okay, so he's a kid, he downloads it. So how do we know he didn't do it from Casey's computer onto his MySpace? And we know when you look up something on the internet, you get spammed constantly by those sites. So I found that kind of interesting. Plus, neck breaking was looked, but neck breaking was never a part to this equation that we know about. So
there is a club in the Orlando area that
mm-hmm.
is called, it's either called Neck Break or Neck Breakers or Neck Breaking. So, you know, I think that, and that hasn't come up in the trial, but I think we'd need to look at that. Maybe, you know, we know that she went to Club Fusion, so maybe she was looking to go to this club. I don't know, but that hasn't come up yet, but I do know it's a club in that area, or at the time, I don't even know if it's still open. At that time, it was a club in the area. So, you know, there's just a lot of, let's have the answers, let's have the truth, and, you know, apparently the public and including myself, I'm not getting any truth, you know?
Yeah, nobody's getting any truth from either Baez or Casey, because what surprised the heck out of me was his opening statement. I think it surprised everybody, but furthermore, when your attorney has believed in 100% of your innocence, as he's been quoted on the Today Show, over the course of 3 years, I guess she must have changed her story in the end here, because for him to change and call her a liar that there was no Zanny, it's definitely a weird weird case, to say the least.
Yeah,
someone's posting,
today.
Andrew Weiner lied to Weiner lied to Congress. Is he a murderer? Good point. Very valid point. And the Neckbreakers is a club of souped-up cars and trucks. Laugh out loud. And not neck breakers, neck breaking. Okay. And I find, you know, I find a lot of, a lot of people have become celebrities, if you will, from this case too. You see the lady with the pen, you know, for the line setup. You know, what was she called? The marker or something? She's on there. You've got people that flew in from London. You've got people that lined up overnight only to find out that there was no trial today, so they lose their place in line. And all of these people are doing interviews and they're, you know, automatic superstars on CNN. So it's amazing. And a lot of journalists have said that Orlando has definitely become a huge tourist attraction, but more so than O.J. Simpson's trial ever did. So I find it amazing. Our good friend from Orlando, PI, breaking news from WKMG at 11 p.m. tonight. Breaking news on this case, Orlando, PI. So for those of you listening that are in the Orlando area, tune in. I think WKMG is, what station is that, WKMG? Is that Kathy Bellish?
I don't know.
Yeah, so those in Orlando, tune in or log on to WKMG's website. Something about George's mistress. You've heard it here. Anyway, the drama continues. But it will be interesting what happens this week in that courtroom, because I'll tell you, we did not anticipate last night. We had criminal attorney Eric Dubois on. We had Beth on last night, and I can tell you that it really was mind-boggling to see where everything went today.
Crazy times,
and I just hope Cheney starts to take over, because I really think that I wouldn't want Baez defending me at this point. And that's humble opinion. Say that again.
I think I agree with you, Michelle.
Something about River Cruise tonight. So at any rate, I thank everybody for tuning in. We encourage you to visit us again next Sunday when we do our normal weekly wrap-up of the trial for the week, and we're moving into week 5 now. So come on back and listen to us. If you haven't listened to any of the past shows, you feel free and download those podcasts, share them, and get the conversation going, because everybody has the ability to have a voice for justice. And in this case, I know I speak for all of our panel tonight. Our only purpose is making sure justice prevails for little Kaylee Marie and no one else. And so let your voices be heard, folks. Thank you again.
Thank you,
Shelley. And we'll talk with everybody later. I'm going to end tonight with Kaylee singing. This was done on Father's Day, June 15th, 2008, at the assisted living of her great-grandfather. And I just want everyone to realize why we're all here. Thank you so much and good night.
Never know, dear, how much I'm hungry. Mama, Papa, the Christmas bees in my room. Because Papa was a too late. What? Eat more! I'm done. Ready.
The pictures where they say